This is Wayne Wagner for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We continue with a reading of the book Blind Justice by Judge Craig Brown. We pick up in Chapter 4 with the trial of Richard Nelms. Once again, we faced our good-natured nemesis, Assistant District Attorney Mike Nifong, who represented the state. "Hey, your client really wants a trial jury facing the death penalty," he asked us. "I'm afraid so," I told him. As it always is, jury selection in a capital case is tedious and painstaking. During the Vaughters capital trial 2.5 years before, I had noticed that Nifong got antsy and tired with the last two seats in the jury box. Lo and behold, he did so again. So I snuck two black women onto the jury. It took us a better share of a week to select the jury and three alternates. Following selection of jurors, the clerk, Lou Constantino, impaneled the jury. The next step thereafter was for the state to arraign the defendant, which means how the defendant pleads in the various charges against him. How does the defendant plead to first-degree murder? Not guilty. How does the defendant plead to robbery with a dangerous weapon? Not guilty. The state's evidence began with testimony by the lead detective on the Nelms murder case, crime scene investigator Post. Post was a detective in the New York City Police Department for about 20 years and was finishing his career with the Durham Police Department. The prosecutor introduced the detective to the jury, and his testimony began. From the very beginning, the detective's testimony was uncharacteristically confused. The district attorney asked him the same question 2 times, then 3 times. Still no good answer. "There were 3 murders in 2 days, investigator Post explained. I looked at A.S. with a grim smile on my face and whispered, "Unbelievable. Investigator Post has not read his report." A.S. smiled back at me. "I can't wait for cross-examination." When the state's direct examination of Investigator Post ended 45 minutes later, the prosecutor's jaw clenched, forming a perfect L down the side of his chin. He was furious. After the trial was over, he would tell us that he had never seen a detective so unprepared in a capital murder case in his entire career. Surprisingly, the state's first witness in this capital murder case had been a gift to the defendant. A.S. pounced on him in cross-examination. What follows is taken directly from the trial transcript. Question. Now, in the evidence section of your death sentence investigation report, answer. Yes, there was a typographical error there. Question. I'm sorry. Answer. Yes, sir. Question. You indicate item number 8. Answer. Yes, sir. Question. As being a .25 caliber FIE Corp clip, I think Corp is the .25 caliber handgun recovered. Is that correct? Yes, sir. Question. Clip and 8 bullets? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Found next to the deceased's right hand? Answer. Yes, sir. That's a typographical error. It should have been 4 bullets. Question. You had a chance to review that before you signed off on it, didn't you? Answer. Yes, sir. It was corrected later on. Question. Well, on this report, it says 8, does it not? Answer. Yes, it does. Mr. Nifong. Objection. He's arguing with a witness. I object. It is argumentative. Court. Overruled. Go ahead. While A.S.'s cross-examination of Investigator Post was powerful, the case still had one major problem. Ballistics matched the bullet in Nelm's arm with bullets from Lee's gun. Given Nelm's prior criminal history, we could not put him on the witness stand. Since there were no other witnesses present at the crime scene when the murder occurred, the only evidence that we could offer to explain the bullet in Nelm's arm was in our final argument before the jury. With the state and defendant being rested, it was time for closing arguments during the guilt phase. They stood up and walked quietly before the jury. He argued for about 30 minutes about the weakness of the state's case and the state's failure to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Finally, he explained the bullet in Nelm's arm. Richard Nelms was on the floor trying to avoid the robbery that was occurring in front of him. He was struck in the arm by a deflected bullet from Ricardo Lee's gun, A.S. explained to the jury. To be frank, that was about the only explanation we could come up with about how the bullet got there other than our client was guilty. I ask that you find Richard Nelms not guilty of first-degree murder and robbery with a dangerous weapon, A.S. concluded. Mike Nifong was one of the best assistant prosecutors around. I have tried about a half dozen cases with him, and I am always amazed at his ability to tie the facts of the defendant's case to fit the state's case and the defendant's guilt. So, Nifong, dressed in a navy blue blazer and cream-colored pants, walked confidently in front of the jury. He said, "I can't believe I'm going to do this." Then he flopped onto the floor and mimicked how the defendant said he had been shot. In the span of 30 seconds on the courtroom floor, Nifong completely destroyed our defense. After the trial was over, I told him that was the only time I had ever put him on the floor. We both laughed. The jury came back in about 6 hours and convicted Richard Nelms of first-degree murder and armed robbery. While not unexpected, A.S. and I were a little surprised by the speed of the jury's verdict, but we were confident of a life sentence, since we had about 3 days of psychiatric and other testimony to present to the jury during the sentencing phase. As we walked out, even Nifong conceded that it was probably a life case. After we left the courtroom, we went downstairs to the Durham County Jail to visit our client. We found Richard Nelms no longer cocky and arrogant. Rather, he was cold, remote, and distant. He gave us an evil look. We again explained the next process in the case, the sentencing phase, and he nodded in understanding. As we got to the elevator, A.O. said, "Let's try to save his life." Both of us spent most of the intervening weekend in our offices preparing for the sentencing phase. Neither of us was prepared for the surprise ending to this capital murder case. When we got back to the courtroom the following Monday morning, the air was abuzz with rumors. A sheriff's deputy approached us laughing. "Your client tried to escape last night." "If you're kidding, that's not funny," A.S. growled at the deputy. "You've got to be kidding." As it turned out, on Sunday evening before trial, Nelms had placed a 4-inch metal shank in the sole of his shoe, faked an injury in the jail shower, placed blue pants underneath his orange jumpsuit, and almost got out of the courthouse before he was strip-searched. "What do we do now?" I asked A.S. "The only thing we can do now is to eliminate all positive character evidence from mitigating factors," I told A.S. In the aftermath of our client's attempted escape, we absolutely had to keep all evidence of his attempt from being put in front of the jury. If a juror knew that, the likelihood of a death sentence would be vastly increased. The only way to keep it out was not to include any positive character evidence. Assistant District Attorney Nifong did not have to agree to our striking more than 30 mitigating factors to avoid putting evidence of Nelms' escape attempt before the jury. But he agreed to do so with a grim smile on his face. Nelms came down to the courtroom, surrounded by a phalanx of sheriff's deputies. A leg iron had been placed on his right leg. We explained to him the consequences of his attempted escape.
I didn't know, he repeated several times.
"Well, why don't you let us be the lawyers in your case?" I shot back at him. I slowly went through each of our 40-plus mitigating factors, eliminating those that made any positive reference to Nelms' character. By the time we were done, half an hour later, his 40-plus mitigating factors had been cut in half. In fact, he now only had 2 mitigating factors, that he was crazy, a trait which can be attributed to most murderers, and that he had a bad life, which probably half of the jury had. What followed was the weakest sentencing phase evidence that I have ever put before a jury. The jurors were a little befuddled and somewhat confused. They did not understand why we did not put on more of a sentencing phase. Suddenly, in almost an instant, a light sentence case had been transformed radically into a real death penalty case. Fortunately, Nelms' great aunt, dressed in white and riding a white scooter, made an impassioned plea for her nephew's life. Her cousin did the same thing. Nifong was cold and intense when he rose for the state's final argument. Quote,
Richard Nelms stole money and murdered Ricardo Lee. There is no colder type of murder. He deserves a death penalty, unquote. When I rose to speak to the jury, a pit welled up in my stomach. I was angry with my client for his stupidity and for the circumstances that we now faced. Quote, "This is nothing but a convenience store murder, pure and simple," I told the jury. I could feel their collective heat of disgust about that argument. I abandoned it quickly. Quote, "What kind of community have we become if we sentence every murderer to death?" Unquote, I asked the jury. I called upon them to use their sense of compassion, mercy, and fairness, and to sentence Richard Nelms to life in prison. I sat down. I was very exhausted and spent. After the jury was sent out to deliberate and the alternate juries were released, Aus and I spoke with one of the alternates in the hallway. "I can't believe how little evidence you put on in the sentencing phase," she told us. We explained that Richard Nelms had attempted to escape from jail the night before the sentencing phase of the trial began. "You're kidding," she looked at us belief. "Well, no wonder if that evidence had gotten in front of the jury, he would have been sentenced to death in a heartbeat." We knew that, and hence our strategy. Being present in the court for a jury verdict in a capital murder case is about as intense as the practice of law can ever be. The stakes are so high. The jury knocked on the jury door to indicate a verdict. "Your Honor, the jury has a verdict," the bailiff said. "Bring the jury in," Superior Court Judge Orlando F. Hudson, Jr. said. One by one, the jurors filed in and took their seats in the jury box. As they filed in, I turned to my legal assistant, Sharon Gittin, and quietly asked her, "Are the jurors looking at us?" "No," she replied. I began to sweat, the sweat of a man in fear. "Does the jury have a unanimous verdict?" Judge Hudson said. "No, Your Honor, we do not," the foreperson responded. A great and collective sigh of relief arose from the defense table. In North Carolina, a death sentence requires a unanimous jury verdict. Since the jury verdict was not unanimous, Richard Nelms would be sentenced to life imprisonment. Shortly after the verdict, Judge Hudson polled every individual juror to determine how they voted. The final vote was 10-2 in favor of a death sentence. The two jurors who voted for life were the last two jurors seated on the jury. While jury selection may be like watching paint dry, this case was won in jury selection. We were exhausted and overjoyed. Despite the best efforts of Richard Nelms to the contrary, he narrowly avoided the death penalty. It is thanks to the skill of his trial counsel that no evidence of his attempted escape went before the jury, which is the only reason he didn't get the death penalty. Or, as a lawyer friend told me the following day, "You all got a good look at the hangman, I guess." "Yes," I replied, "but the hangman blinked." Timothy Keel. In the summer of 1995, Brian Ayers and I began representing Timothy Keel, who was on death row at Central Prison in Raleigh for the July 10th, 1990 murder of his father-in-law. When the initial death sentence was overturned on appeal, a second Edgecombe County jury again convicted Keel of first-degree murder and again sentenced him to death. To make a murder case a capital offense, the state must prove at least one grossly aggravating factor. The grossly aggravating factor in Keel's case was especially horrible. 10 years before, he was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for the murder of his then 2-year-old son. Central Prison in downtown Raleigh is an imposing structure. When we first met Timothy Keel, A.S. and I were searched and then passed through three heavy steel doors before we entered the interrogation booth. Timothy Keel was a white man of medium build, then in his early 40s. At the time of the 1990 murder, Keel abused cocaine and alcohol. Keel had a borderline IQ, which had actually increased during his imprisonment. His IQ now stood at 76. He was a pleasant, sometimes even jovial, client. In 1995, the North Carolina General Assembly had defunded the Death Penalty Resource Center, which served defense capital defense attorneys through the state. We were on our own. Over the summer, AS and I prepared a lengthy motion for appropriate relief, in which we contended that there were errors or mistakes made by prior attorneys in the case. We visited Tarboro, the county seat of Edgecombe County. We interviewed his previous attorneys, witnesses, and previous jurors. The state was represented by Valerie Spaulding, a tall, thin, blonde-haired attorney from Latin America. While that was a pleasant description, she was a fierce opponent. On behalf of the state, Spaulding moved to dismiss our motion for appropriate relief, contending that we were procedurally barred from filing it. Ayos and I had never heard of such a defense to our motion. In fact, the state made it up in death row cases all across the country. Nevertheless, when the matter was heard by Superior Court Judge Frank Brown, who had presided over all three Keel murder cases, our motion for appropriate relief was summarily dismissed. We appealed to the North Carolina Supreme Court. In the meantime, despite our appeal of his ruling, Judge Frank Brown set a new execution date for Keel. We spent the days around Christmas of 1995 seeking a stay of execution from the North Carolina Supreme Court, which granted it. For whatever reason, the North Carolina Supreme Court upheld the procedural bar, and we then prepared a habeas corpus complaint in federal court. About the time that the federal court habeas corpus petition was to be heard, I was appointed to the state district court bench by North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt. Consequently, I withdrew from Keel's case. The procedural bar issue was appealed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, and ultimately to the United States Supreme Court. While that appeal was pending, the state dropped its procedural bar argument. The state's argument probably added about a year to Keel's life. In the interim, Ayers and Keel's new attorney, Jay Ferguson, requested discovery from the state. Once again, Edgecombe County Superior Court Judge Frank Brown denied Keel's request. Keel then appealed to the North Carolina Supreme Court, which granted his request. However, the Edgecombe County District Attorney's Office was reluctant to comply with the Supreme Court order. In fact, they avoided compliance with the discovery order, which added another 2 years to Keel's life. Ultimately, all state and federal appeals of Keel's death sentence were denied. Timothy Keel was put to death by the state of North Carolina on November 7th, 2003. Chapter 5. Build It and They Will Come. According to FBI statistics, 80% of all criminal activity is related to substance abuse. This percentage has remained constant since the 1970s. In 2001, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services estimated that 7.3% of all Americans have a chronic substance abuse problem. That figure amounts to 16.6 million Americans, to be more specific. Among all the criminal defendants that I represented, a substance abuse issue was the rule rather than the exception. Heroin, cocaine, ecstasy, LSD, oxycodone, a multitude of prescription drugs, crack, all of the drugs were part of the defendant's problems that led to criminal activity. Simply stated, a lot of criminal activity is caused by addicts stealing in one way or another to get money to buy drugs or alcohol. But recovery from substance abuse is deeper than just the drug problem. In almost all cases, there are a multitude of issues that need to be addressed. For example, the failure to obtain a high school diploma or a GED, the absence of social skills, the lack of a work ethic, mental health issues, and housing issues, among other things. Freedom House. Freedom House, located in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, opened in 1974 and now includes services not only for alcohol and drug rehabilitation, but also for the mentally ill and individuals with developmental disabilities. Over the decades, Freedom House has helped thousands of Durham, Chatham, Person, and Orange County residents to recover from addiction and have helped with their mental illnesses, too. The addiction issue hit close to home when I committed my brother Chris for alcoholism in December of 2005. Freedom House saved my brother's life. For years, I knew that Chris had a drinking problem, but he was very clever about hiding it. Like many alcoholics, he worked every day, had a family, and one child. When his landscaping business failed in 2001, I knew that he was headed for trouble. After that, his drinking problem grew, such that he no longer had a job and was drinking all the time. Chris also wasn't eating enough, and he was nothing but skin and bones. Frankly, I was afraid that he might drink himself to death. So, on December 4th, 2005, several friends and I had an intervention session with Chris. We confronted him with his drinking and urged him to go into rehabilitation. He wanted to put it off until after Christmas. Since I thought that he might not live to see Christmas, I pulled the trigger the following day and signed commitment papers to commit him for immediate alcohol treatment. Then the waiting game began. Every morning I would call Chief Magistrate Chet Dobies to see if the commitment papers had been served. Every morning Dobies would growl no and reissue the commitment papers yet again. The problem was that the authorities would not enter my brother's apartment to get him, and Chris would not answer the door. I made some phone calls, and Chris finally called me on December 7th and asked me why people were knocking on his door and police lights were flashing outside. I told him why, and that he needed to go into alcohol treatment immediately. However, the police still could not enter his apartment, and he was refusing to exit. In utter despair, I spoke with my friend and colleague, Chief District Court Judge Elaine Bushfan. I explained the entire situation to her and my intense frustration. I was almost crying. So Judge Bushfan made a few phone calls, too. Her call seemed to get a better response. Imagine that. An hour later, the authorities entered my brother's apartment with the apartment manager and physically removed him to Freedom House's Durham Center access to begin the detoxification process. Durham Center Access provides short-term treatment for adults with mental health, developmental, disability, and substance abuse crises. DCA provides assessments of people in crisis, 11 crisis evaluation and observation beds, and 16 residential beds. Chris's problem was bigger than a temporary solution. After years of work in substance abuse treatment, thank God that I was familiar with recovery facilities. I called my friend Trish Hussey, the director of Freedom House, which provides an array of substance abuse treatment services, including detox and a 6-month drug and alcohol halfway house treatment facility in nearby Chapel Hill. "He is my only brother," I told her, "and I need him to live. We will do the best that we can," Trish told me. Chris went into Freedom House the next day. He was angry with me at first, but came to realize that he was killing himself and that his drinking was accomplishing nothing. His detoxification was severe. For the first 2 weeks, every time I saw him, he was shaking like a leaf. Alcohol is a horrible drug to be addicted to, and the detoxification process must be monitored or it can kill you too. To his credit, Chris committed himself to his recovery. A month later, he went back to work to earn his rent and expenses. His first job at Southern Season didn't pay very much, but it kept him busy, and for the most part, he liked it. When he graduated from Freedom House after staying 6 months in the men's halfway house, they set him up in an apartment complex in Chapel Hill, and he got back on his feet. 4 years later, he still hasn't had a drop to drink, and good for him. He has rebuilt his business and his life. I am now serving on the Freedom House Board of Directors. Given that Freedom House saved my brother's life, I suspect I will be on the board for a good while. Trosa. In late 1992, I began working with others to bring Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers Incorporated, TROSA, into being. In 1994, I worked with many others to make the Durham County Criminal Justice Resource Center a reality. When I took the bench in late 1996, I was a strong advocate for the creation of a drug treatment court in Durham County, which began operations in 1999. We is more powerful than I. Too many people assisted in building these three programs for me to credit them all here, but their help was invaluable. Since the mid-1980s, my legal practice increasingly involved the representation of indigent criminal defendants. Like many communities, Durham County had a criminal indigent list, which private attorneys could join after meeting certain requirements. In 1990, the criminal appointments list was supplemented by the creation of an Office of the Public Defender. I learned quickly that many criminal defendants were chronic substance abusers who stole or robbed people to gain money for their drug habits. As the Vaughters trial underscored, there was a complete absence of long-term substance abuse treatment for poor people in Durham County. After the Vaughters case concluded, I knew that I had to invest a considerable amount of my time to bring about a long-term residential drug treatment facility in Durham County. Several weeks after the verdict in the Vaughters case, I attended my second meeting of TROSA, a dedicated band of substance abuse professionals and interested persons seeking to develop a long-term facility in the Triangle area. The opening conversation was crisp. Craig, we need you to lead, one board member said. What do you mean, I asked. We want you to chair the board, another board member explained. I looked around the room with what remaining eyesight I had. I saw the nods of consensus. I'll be happy to, I responded, but only on one condition, that this is a team effort. And so, quietly, I became the chairman of the TROSA board, a position that I served in from 1992 until 1996. But where to begin? Starting any program is never easy, and actually running it on a full-time basis is even more difficult. The first thing that the board had to decide was what model of a treatment facility we wanted. A short-term facility, say 6 months of treatment or less? A medium-term facility of 1 year or so? Or a true long-term residential substance abuse treatment facility? After several months of wrangling and meetings, consensus became clear. We wanted to establish a long-term, 2-year residential treatment facility in the Triangle. Our model would be based on a version of the Delancey Street model, perhaps the most famous long-term substance abuse model in the United States. Like Delancey Street, TROSA would only take volunteers into the program. Put more simply, we did not want a new resident if that individual had not volunteered for the program and/or been accepted by more senior TROSA residents. The old adage that you can't con a con would thus be well tested. We envisioned a program that would be at least 2 years in length, with wraparound substance abuse, life skill, educational, and job training for the individual resident. As the official TROSA history states, honesty, compassion, self-discipline, accountability, empathy, a strong work ethic, and most importantly, a true concern for others would guide residents and staff through the process of changing their lives. TROSA would start up multiple businesses within the organization, staffed by the sober, drug-addicted population that made up TROSA residents. Income from these businesses, especially the moving company, would then be used to offset some or all of TROSA's expenses. Unlike the Delancey Street model, TROSA would pay its various staff members. With a treatment model now in place, who would lead it? The TROSA board felt that we needed a former drug addict, believing that peers learn best from someone else in their peer group. From the very beginning, TROSA had only one thought about who its director would be. Kevin McDonald, a 12-year Delancey Street veteran who led the development of a small Delancey Street program in Greensboro, a city some 60 miles west of Durham. Kevin first came to visit our board in early 1993. We were all favorably impressed. However, Kevin did not think we were ready, and he turned down our job offer. We were devastated. But over the next year, we continued to maintain contact with him and to pursue him as our first executive director, and we hoped he would be. In January 1994, our luck changed. Kevin had left Delancey Street the year before, taking over as director of a federal substance abuse program for parolees in Los Angeles, California. That January, a sharp earthquake hit the Los Angeles area, killing scores of people and causing millions of dollars in property damage. Kevin McDonald had no love of earthquakes, and he wanted out. That month, he signed a contract to become the first executive director of TROSA, beginning on March 1, 1994. On March 2nd, his second day on the job, Kevin McDonald and I attended a joint meeting of the county commissioners and the Durham City and County School Boards. After many years of racial division and divisiveness, Durham had finally decided to merge the city and county schools. The school merger created the opportunity to obtain one of the vacant elementary schools near downtown Durham. All concerned believed that a former school would be an ideal place for a residential treatment facility. I spoke to the joint board for about 2 minutes, asking them to give TROSA the old North Durham Elementary School facility. Kevin then stood up and spoke for about 10 minutes, explaining to the board what the TROSA program was and how much we needed to have the old North Durham Elementary School. It was the first time that I watched and listened to Kevin McDonald work, and I was impressed. TROSA had a spirited leader at the helm, and I viewed continued progress as almost inevitable. 2 weeks later, the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce gave TROSA $35,000, which sum represented the largest grant that TROSA had received in its young history. The TROSA board could now truthfully guarantee Kevin McDonald his salary for the next year. The involvement in and investment of the business community was key to the development of TROSA's businesses within the program, as well as in attracting other private funds. One obstacle remained, however, the support of the neighborhood around the old North Durham Elementary School. I did not want to make a formal request for the old elementary school without talking to the leaders in that community first, fearing that sense of deja vu if we did not. In May of 2004, we arranged to speak to the Neighborhood Association about taking over the old North Durham Elementary School. Kevin picked me up at my law offices downtown shortly before the meeting. We swung by the McDonald's restaurant in downtown Durham first. I was puzzled. "Why are we going to McDonald's to eat before a dinner meeting?" I asked him. "Because we're not going to eat at the meeting, and it might be ugly," McDonald responded in his usual brusque fashion. There was only one thing I had learned you could say about Kevin McDonald. He was straightforward and right to the point. I didn't know what to expect from the meeting with the Neighborhood Association. Let's just say that long-term residential substance abuse facilities are not on the top 10 list for new programs you want in your neighborhood. Like most communities, Durham sometimes suffered from the NIMBY, not in my backyard, movement. To our surprise, we were greeted warmly as we entered the meeting hall. We each chatted with members of a neighborhood association, ate a bit more of dinner, and then came our turn. This was one of those meetings where you would come out with your sword above you or impaled upon it. I was nervous when the neighborhood association president introduced me. I rose to speak, and it all fell into place. I thanked the Neighborhood Association for inviting us, and then I explained what the TROSA program was and how we needed to use this school to get it started. I implored the crowd of neighbors, property owners, and renters to realize the importance of providing a long-term substance abuse facility free of charge to chronic drug addicts. "We will never solve the drug problem without this kind of program," I implored them. Then, as Kevin McDonald began to speak, I witnessed beauty in action. In a few short months, as he and I made joint appearances before various groups in Durham, Kevin had come to refer to us as the straight guy and the drug addict. "I started using heroin when I was 16, he told the crowd. "I used it almost every day from then until I was 32. I have committed robberies, I have hurt people, and I thought I was tougher and meaner and better than the rest of you." The crowd listened intently. I suspect this was not what they expected. "But I was nobody when I was high," Kevin continued. "When I got locked up for my last armed robbery, the judge gave me a choice. I could either go to Delancey Street, or I could spend 8 to 10 years in prison. I thought he was conning me, and I took the easy choice, Delancey Street." "Well, that was the last time I ever thought Delancey Street was easy," Kevin chuckled. "I learned there that I didn't need drugs, that I was somebody, and I had a lot of work to do. That's the kind of program we were going to try to bring to Durham, and we need your help." After about 30 minutes of rhetoric flourish, the floor was turned over for questions. "How can you ensure the safety of our community?" one neighborhood association member asked. "We can't," Kevin responded. "But you have to remember that every resident in TROSA is there because they want to be. If they want to leave, we'll give them a bus ticket out of town," McDonald explained. "How can you ensure that your program will not reduce our property values?" another neighbor asked. "We can't," Kevin said. "But we intend to fix up the school, which has been a vacant eyesore in this neighborhood for the past 5 years. An hour later, Kevin and I left the meeting exhausted but exhilarated. We had come to the meeting with no illusions, and we left the meeting with their support. 5 days later, the Durham County Commissioners gave to TROSA the old North Durham Elementary School, a 32,000-square-foot facility. As I entered the building for the very first time several days later, a musty smell struck me in the face. "That will take a lot of work," I told Kevin. He agreed. Back in the 1920s, the building had served as an elementary school until 1968. About a decade later, the building was renovated and used for an office facility for the Durham City Schools. The building had been vacant since the late 1980s, and it looked it. About 700 windows were broken in the building. Water damage was everywhere. The boiler had long since failed to work. The basement was used as a shooting gallery for drug addicts. For me, my return to the North Durham Elementary School was filled with memories. This was the same school where some 25 years earlier, I was a fourth and fifth grade student. I recall the warm but stern words of Miss Itings, my fourth grade teacher. I walked into my fifth grade classroom and remembered that day in April of 1968 that I saw the Durham National Guards through the classroom window. I remembered how they had arrived to say goodbye to their children before they went on picket duty in Greensboro after the death of Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Anyway, 5 months later, on October 10th, 1994, Trosa accepted its first resident. By Christmas 1994, there were about 10 residents. There was also no heat in the North Durham school. Fortunately, we had a mild winter. In early 1995, Trosa went before the Durham City Council to seek financial support for further growth of Trosa. After several attempts, I managed to get then Chief District Court Judge Kevin Titus to join us and offer his words of support to City Council as well. Of course, Judge Titus told me he couldn't ask for money, since that would violate the Code of Judicial Conduct. I told him that was my job. Then, District Attorney Jim Harden wrote then-Durham Mayor Perry Rodenheiser a letter supporting Trosa as well. Rodenheiser read the letter into the record, and after Judge Titus was done, there wasn't too much left for me to say. Trosa received $50,000 from the City of Durham in 1995 and for several years thereafter, and still received city financial support in different ways. By 1995, the middle of it, we had over 60 residents. Today, in 2009, Trosa has over 320 residents at three different facilities in the city of Durham. Trosa also owns over 30 houses for graduates of the program to begin working their way back into the community following their treatment. Trosa stands as a shining example of what a community can do when it works together. By bringing together civic leaders, city and county government, and the business community, Trosa has become a reality in Durham. Thanks to the work of the initial Trosa board and, more importantly, Kevin McDonald and the staff of residents of Trosa, Trosa has become the largest residential substance abuse treatment program of its kind in the southeastern United States. And for my efforts on behalf of Trosa, I received the 1995 Pro Bono Service Award from the North Carolina Bar Association. The Durham County Criminal Justice Resource Center. In 1994, the North Carolina General Assembly passed the State Partnership Act in conjunction with the creation of structured sentencing. The Partnership Act directed interested counties to form a broad-based partnership board to implement a single facility where the needs of probated criminal offenders could be met. Services such as substance abuse treatment, education, job training, cognitive behavioral intervention, and or anger management were to be offered at one location. The Durham County Criminal Justice Resource Center opened in 1996 and served about 100 clients. Gudrun Palmer became director of the Resource Center in 1998, and the program took off. The Resource Center chose to focus on three goals. First, the delivery of quality services so offenders and at-risk youth can become productive, successful citizens. Secondly, the supervision and monitoring of high-risk offenders residing in Durham County to increase public safety. And thirdly, to collect and disseminate various information, including criminal and treatment histories. In the late 90s, the Second Chance Drug Treatment Program merged with the Resource Center. The STAR program joined the Resource Center in 2001. The STAR program is a jail-based short-term drug treatment program for offenders being housed in the Durham County Jail. In 2005, a pretrial program was added to the Resource Center. The pretrial program obtains criminal histories for all criminal defendants on the first appearance calendar and interviews each defendant to determine their risk level if they are released on an unsecured bond. Pretrial services targets nonviolent offenders who do not have multiple failures to appear in the previous 2 years, but will also monitor high-risk defendants on a case-by-case basis. In 2009, the Resource Center served over 2,000 people. Drug Treatment Court. When I took the bench in 1996, I was already a drug treatment court advocate. In this court, drug addicts report to the presiding judge every 2 weeks. The drug treatment team includes the district attorney's office, the public defender's office, mental health personnel, substance abuse treatment offenders, the Durham City Police Department, and case managers. The program also focuses on the employment and housing needs of the drug treatment court members. In Durham, the initial development of a drug treatment court was slowed by the opposition of then District Attorney Jim Hardin. Over time, Hardin relented. In 1998, we began planning for the development of the Durham Drug Treatment Court, which went into operation in 1999. The Durham Drug Treatment Court volume ranges from 20 to 30 individuals at any given time. The treatment team would review every drug treatment court client individually to determine who was doing well and who was not. In advance, the treatment team would agree upon punishment or rewards for each client. Treatment team meetings were spirited conversations with each team member, sometimes taking different sides on a given case. Each member is called before the judge every 2 weeks, and the treatment team advises the court of their progress or lack of same. Drug treatment court judges have the ability to reward defendants who are doing well and to punish those who are not. Recent studies indicate that addicts ordered to treatment have roughly the same level of success as addicts who volunteer for treatment. Chapter 6, The Bad and the Good. I appeared in Durham County Superior Court on a Tuesday after the University of North Carolina won the National Basketball Championship in 1993. Superior Court Judge J. Milton Reed was on the bench. Reed was a Carolina man through and through. Then District Attorney Jim Hardin was calling the criminal calendar. Hardin was a Duke man. When Hardin called my client's name, I rose from my seat and addressed Judge Reed, commenting on what a beautiful Carolina blue morning that was. Judge Reed smiled broadly and happily agreed. Hardin cleared his throat. He couldn't help it. Again, he was a Duke man, after all. Later that month, I went to the beach with my then-Duke family. I wrote a poem for the occasion that I have since lost, which is probably a good thing. But I do remember one line. Quote, Eric Montrose in the middle and Donald Williams for three. They both led to the North Carolina victory, unquote. My Duke family did not appreciate that very much. From 1993 until 1995, I continued with a large amount of serious felony criminal work before the Superior Court bench, including trial of one death penalty case to verdict. Because of my blindness, I removed myself from the court-appointed list in September of 1995. That fall, I settled the largest personal injury case in the history of my law firm and continued other aspects of my private legal practice. I first began thinking about running for Durham County District Court Judge in January 1996. I knew then that William Y. Manson, currently a serving judge, intended to retire at the end of his term in December of 1998. One has to prepare well in advance to run for a judicial post. That same month, I met with several prominent attorneys whom I'd known since I began practicing in 1983. I next met with Travis Porter. Porter is a Durham lawyer who has served as chairman of the UNC-CH Board of Trustees as well as chairman of the UNC Board of Governors. He was an extremely powerful ally of Governor Jim Hunt. He had been active in Durham politics since the mid-1960s, and he was an excellent bridge to the black community, one of the few white businessmen in Durham who had accomplished that feat. Consequently, his experience, expertise, and friendship were also key to him serving as an initial advisor for the election effort. As the spring progressed, I began trying to attract other lawyers to support my future candidacy. Then, suddenly, rumors began surfacing about Manson's early retirement. I first heard of these rumors in late May 1996, and they persisted. On June 15, 1996, Judge Manson announced his retirement in the Durham Herald, and the campaign was on. To complete the campaign committee chairman, I also sought the support of Brian Ayers, another Durham lawyer. Brian and I had worked on a capital case, State versus Nelms, in 1995. Later, we had served as co-counsel on a death row case in North Carolina, State versus Timothy Keel. It had been a tremendous joy to work with him, and he was well-respected within the Durham bar. At that point, I had both a former prosecutor and a present defense counsel on board. The ticket, however, needed to be complemented by a substantial civil practice. To that end, I sought the assistance of Jimmy Sharp, a well-respected domestic attorney in Durham. In fact, Jimmy was already serving as my own attorney in that capacity. He would provide a link to the civil bar, which is the largest element of the bar in Durham County when it comes to district court. During the months of June and July 1996, I called every single attorney in Durham County. Seriously, I did. All 800 of them. By the time I was finished, I had my three-minute voicemail down pat. The Durham County Bar Association voted on July 29th for its top three choices for the vacant district court judgeship in Durham County. Ann McCown got 242 votes, I received 152, and Marcia Morey received 136. The next morning, former Durham City Mayor and then State Senator Wib Gully approached Hunt's legislative counsel, Jim Phillips, and State Senate Majority Leader Roy Cooper on the Senate floor. Gully advised them of the Durham County Bar vote and asked for support of his candidate. Phillips and Cooper looked at each other, then at Gully. Almost in unison, they told Gully, "We're for Brown." From that moment forward, Gully knew that his candidate was in a bit of trouble. Like anyone else seeking a political appointment, I sought to touch all my bases and talk to all of my potential supporters. I figured that none of the remaining candidates had the support of Terry Sanford. And as a graduate of Duke's public policy school that he now headed up, I called him for an appointment. "Hello," a gruff voice answered on the phone. I was surprised. I suspect there aren't many former U.S. senators who answer their own business calls. "Senator Sanford?" I asked him. "Yes." I explained to him who I was and why I needed to see him. Surprisingly, he told me to meet him at his office at 10 a.m. the next morning. Terry Sanford was and is a legend in North Carolina Democratic politics. Elected governor of North Carolina in 1960, he went on to spend 15 years as president of Duke University, and then was elected to the United States Senate in 1986. Now, nearly 80 years of age, he was revered and loved throughout the state, and most especially in his hometown of Durham. The following day, I arrived at my scheduled appointment promptly. His secretary announced my presence, and I was led to his office. I walked in the doorway nervously. "Good warm-up for my interview with the governor," I thought to myself. "Come on in," Senator Sanford said as he spotted me in the doorway. I took a couple of steps forward, and I handed him my letter of introduction and resume. Sanford was an imposing man, more than 6 feet tall, with distinct features, white hair, and an astute mind. Sanford gazed at my resume and then looked up a little quizzically. I was not ready for his opening question. "So, what's it like to be blind?" he asked intently. His question did not surprise me. I fully expected that he would ask it, but I surely did not expect it as his first question. And I reeled. Most people are curious about blindness, but very few have the audacity to ask about it. I rocked back and forth on my feet. Thoughts ran through my head as I considered his question. Should I be intellectual? Nah, that would take too long and be entirely too confusing. Should I be stoic? No, that denies reality. So I was honest. It was the easiest thing. "Well," I told him, "it sucks. I still can't believe that I answered his first question that way, but at least he knew that he had a live one here." Senator Sanford chuckled and briefly roared. sit down and let's talk. I took a seat, and for the next 30 minutes, we had a far-reaching discussion about my background in education, my experience, the state of racial justice in North Carolina, and the impact of poverty on it. I was fascinated. I am told that I had his support when he spoke to Governor Hunt about my appointment to the bench. I have never confirmed that fact, but judging from our conversation, I believe it to be true. Hunt and Sanford apparently talked almost every day. My mother, Shirley, never really recovered from my father's death in 1993. They had been married for so long and had such a keen partnership that she was lost without him. In the weeks and months that followed my father's death, she fell into depression and lost a considerable amount of weight. Since Mom was never a heavy woman, weight loss was a serious problem. She was lost without my father, and she was so incredibly lonely. Whatever her medical cause of death, to this day I believe she died of a broken heart. In August of 1996, Mom fell while she was working in the yard, injuring her right leg. At the age of 69, her skin had become like parchment, and the resulting tear never healed properly. Mom spent several weeks at Durham Regional Hospital recovering, and my brother Chris did yeoman's work in finding a rehabilitation center for her to go to for the recovery. She was transferred there on September 5th. That night, Hurricane Fran struck with a vengeance in North Carolina, causing over $2 billion in property and other damages. I have never seen Durham so torn up. Trees were downed everywhere. Power was out over most of Durham for over a week. Everything stopped. I saw her last on the early afternoon of Sunday, September 8th. My brother Chris was kind enough to give me a ride over to the rehabilitation center north of Durham. We walked quietly into her room, and Chris left so Mom and I could talk. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw sunlight shimmering through the yellow curtains behind her. I was struck, even stunned, by her appearance. Her complexion was a pasty white. The hair had turned completely white as well. I gulped. It will not be long, I thought to myself. Mom had not always been lucid in the last month or so, and our initial conversation rambled from topic to topic. She became increasingly impatient with me. Suddenly, without notice, she became entirely lucid and pointed in her remarks. Craig, I am very proud of you for all you have accomplished in your life. You will accomplish much more, but always remember what your father said. I knew quite well what she was referring to. Tears welled up in my eyes and my throat grew husky. I knew the words well, and I repeated them to her, my voice breaking. Always remember what you accomplish in your life, that you put your pants on the same way just like everyone else. She smiled again. Come give your mother a kiss. I reached over to her face and kissed her lightly on the lips. I love you, Craig. Go for it. Those last seven words that my mother spoke to me are burned in my memory, and I will remember them always. On the evening of September 9th, Mom had a bout of shortness of breath. Chris was called to the Trayburn Rehabilitation Center and saw her around 7 p.m. The crisis appeared to have subsided, and Mom was given something to sleep. Chris then came back to Mom's house, where we were staying for the first time together since the house was built in 1985. Because of the hurricane, Mom's house was the only one of our houses in Durham that had power. My brother Chris, his wife Julie, and I were watching Monday Night Football, which was a game between the Philadelphia Eagles and the Green Bay Packers. The fog was so significant that night that we could barely see the game. After 10:30 p.m., the Brown family Bible mysteriously fell from the top shelf onto the floor. This was quite a surprise, since the Bible weighed about 6 pounds and was 8 inches by 12 inches. I didn't give any special significance to this fact until later. Chris's wife, Julie, Chris, and I looked at the Bible, which was made sometime in the early 1900s. The Bible also included a genealogy of the Brown family tree, as well as pictures of Dad as an infant and others of him as a football player on the Fayette, Iowa football team. It was quite a trip back. We then went to bed. At approximately 1:30 a.m. on September 10th, 1996, there was pounding on the front door of Mom's residence. Chris's family was staying there, as well as me. My estranged wife and children were safe in the mountains of North Carolina, which received little impact of the storm. But I knew what had happened. Police do not come seeking you out unless something terrible has occurred. I pretended not to hear the noise of the front door, even though my bedroom was directly next to it. Somehow, I hoped that the noise would go away and that the message that I feared would be forthcoming would not come. But my brother again, bless his heart, answered the door. The police officers directed him to contact the Trayburn Rehabilitation Center. He did so and learned that Mom was dead. The death certificate said that she died of heart failure at about 10:30 p.m. the night before, the same time that the Bible had fallen. I was certain of one thing, that she and Dad are together in heaven, having a good time. After several hours of intermixed crying and talking, we tried to go back to bed. I did not sleep. I went into the office the next morning heartbroken. At approximately 10 a.m. that morning, I contacted Governor Jim Hunt's office. I was scheduled for an interview with the governor regarding my candidacy for a district court judgeship in Durham County. I requested a continuance, or rather a postponement. I spoke to a lady by the name of Judy Harp. She said she would call me back. Approximately 1/2 hour later, Mrs. Harp called me to tell me the interview would go forward. I then contacted my therapist, interestingly enough, to get his advice regarding how I should get through the interview. Brian Ayers drove me to Raleigh. He did not mention my mother during the trip, nor did I. I can still remember the swish of the windshield wipers as we drove through the pouring rain to Raleigh. Somehow, it was calming. Arriving in Raleigh early, we waited patiently under one of the parking decks for the rain to slack before we walked the 2 blocks to the state capitol. Finally, with 1/2 hour to spare, the rain began to subside and we began our journey. There were still trees down on the state capitol grounds from Hurricane Fran. As we arrived, the governor's office in the state capitol was abuzz with disaster details. North Carolina was in the process of cleaning up from the worst storm it had ever received. We were told that we were early, but that events were ahead of schedule and to have a seat. We would learn later what had transpired. The governor's deputy counsel, Jack Jenkins, came out and greeted me. I grabbed his arm and he led me into Governor Hunt's office. The governor's desk was stacked with inches of paper that covered the entire length of the desk. I shook his hand. He greeted me warmly. "I understand that your mother died this morning. Why are you here?" said Governor Hunt. Unbeknownst to the governor, he had opened the trap door. "I called your office this morning to have this interview postponed," I explained. The governor, clearly growing angry, asked, "Who did you talk to?" Unfortunately for her, I remembered her name. "Her name was Judy Harp," I answered. Growing even angrier, Governor Hunt shouted to his deputy counsel who was in the room, "Who is Judy Harp?" "Sometimes she answers the phone for our offices in the Department of Administration," Jenkins replied. The governor took a long, deep sigh and responded, "Not anymore." He then apologized to me for having this interview on this day. Governor Hunt opened the interview by telling me that my resume was superb and that my political support was impressive. We then turned to a conversation about TROSA. Hunt was most intrigued with the idea of a long-term drug rehabilitation facility. Having worked on the TROSA project for the past 4 years, I supplied him with information about how the program began, the sources of its funding, the model behind the program, the work ethic of the program, the educational component, as well as the drug treatment component. Hunt was very impressed. We then turned to the subject of juvenile justice. For the next 15 minutes, the governor asked me a series of questions about juvenile justice in North Carolina. "Would I be able to treat juveniles as adults?" I responded affirmatively. "What did I think of training schools?" I answered that question honestly, as I was not sure of what the training schools accomplished beyond punishment. Our interview closed with a thorough discussion of how I would be efficient as a blind judge in a courtroom setting. I explained to the governor that I had seriously considered that question since January 1996 when I made a decision to seek Judge Manson's seat in the May 1998 primary. This is Wayne Wagner for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We will continue with the book
Blind Justice by Judge Craig Brown next week.